that on Christmas Eve was always the program at church, and we always got this bag. It had mixed nuts and old-fashioned chocolate drops and a little bag of mixed hard candy and a big orange in it, and that's what the gift was from under the tree at everybody at church time. The ladies of the church would get together and put this up before, and that was always nice. But then we used to get maybe a half a box of oranges, because oranges were not that easy to come by, and we didn't have all the shipping and all. And so oranges were always the real great treat at Christmas time, too. And then we used to open the gifts sometime. I think we would open, we'd open them on Christmas Eve before the church party, because there were new clothes under there for you, and then you could wear your new dress or your new blouse to the church party, which was your Christmas present. But I always liked Christmases real well. The thing I disliked, I think, the most, especially when Betty was off to college and I was still in high school or grade school, because I was so much younger than the other girls, is that, we were kind of out in the country and isolated from our other high school friends and all. We did have a few high school friends around the area here too, but it was hard to stay for after school activities, or you always had to get on that bus and come home. There were no, I don't know if around here now, but I know back in many schools they have a late bus that takes the kids home after the activities, and that was kind of missing, I think. But it was kind of fun riding that school bus, except that the kids used to always tease us about riding up into the Swiss Alps, because the bus circled around here, and they used to make fun of us going up in the mountains in the Swiss Alps. But I think a lot of them now would die for some real estate up here.
Yeah, when we went to school, boy, if you lived in Helvetia, you really lived out in the sticks, you know, and you're kind of, I mean, you're kind of looked down on, you know. And in fact, One time they were having an Easter egg hunt at Schutz Park, and some eggs would have a star on, you know, and you'd get a dollar if you found one with a star on. So I talked Dad into taking me over to Hillsboro to see if we could find an egg with a star on. Anyway, here they had all these eggs out there and the thing. And these darn city kids, they went out there and they picked up all the eggs before they even started, you know. I thought, man, what a bunch of cheats, you know. Yeah. Well, that's kind of the way city kids were then, you know. But, you know, they really looked down on people, you know, if you lived out in the sticks, you know. But now it's kind of turned around. I went to a ball game one time, and I know, lady in front of me was saying something, oh, so-and-so, you live in Helvetia, you know. You know, it was a big, it was a 180-degree turnaround anyway.
The intramurals in high school were always the city kids against the country kids, and that was a big dividing line. Maybe even when you went to school, and I don't remember if it changed by that time or not, but we were called country kids and they were called city kids.
Where was the first school that you went to?
Yeah. Which one was the only school with the only teacher was about, it was right across the bottom part of the property. It was called the Helvetia School, District Number 55. My first year teacher was Mrs. Pollock, and after that, after she had enough, she left, and gentleman, Joe Wenzel, came and transformed the country, and he stayed for, oh boy, it must have been 15 years or so. I had him all the way through school, and I think...
I had him all the way through school.
And Bob, I think...
I think I had him through fifth grade.
He was we worshipped him like he was God, and we still do. But Dad used to get kind of jealous because we would come home and anything, if the discussion came up about something, and if Dad didn't think the way Joe Wenzel did, why, Joe Wenzel was right and Dad was wrong. And he was just a real tremendous teacher and took us all over, and we did more extracurricular fun activities. Maybe that's what I missed in high school then, that I didn't have all these extracurricular activities that we had in the elementary school. He used to take us into J.K. Gill's to pick out plays for the school to put on, and he used to take us out in the Salmonberry River to go trout, steelhead fishing with him, and he taught us how to graft trees, and he taught us everything, and we just thought he was really pretty great.
How many children were in the classroom?
There were 8 in my graduating class, which was a rather large class in those days, I believe, because there were probably
usually about 30 in school.
30 or 35 in the.
When my classmate moved away and another one was let back a year, then I was the only one in the class. So then he let me take 2 classes in 1 year. So I graduated. I only went to elementary school 7 years.
So did he taught all 30 of the children? All 8 grades. All 8 grades. Interesting. Enormous responsibility.
All subjects. I mean, mm-hmm. It's amazing.
What were the subjects?
Right, arithmetic.
Geography.
Civics, he was great on.
Man, sing God Bless America.
Old Black Joe.
And used to really sing God Bless America, you know, it kind of really.
Work for the Night is Coming. Somebody said they walked by the school one day and these kids are all saying, "Work for the Night is Coming." Cracked up.
He planted a school garden, and he developed these playgrounds, a basketball court out of the dirt playground, and they had high jumping and pole vaulting, and a great sports program. And we would go to other schools and play them. There weren't enough boys for the basketball team, so I got to play in the boys' basketball team.
At the end of the year, we had a picnic with Rock Creek. And that was a big event.
We used to get Neapolitan ice cream.
Everybody would.
Blocked with your chocolate.
Everybody would be there, all the parents, and it was a big celebration. That was the biggest day. That was the day of my life, biggest day of the year, I think, for me.
Well, he also led the Boy Scouts and had the
Galicia
band. And then he led the community band. The Boy Scouts, they built a cabin up on Jackson Falls. Did you ever spend the night up there?
Not the night. I spent a lot of days up there.
I spent one night there, and it was cool hell. I froze to death, but then they would dig swimming holes once in a while. They had swimming pools around and play the creek and try to dam it up. It worked for a while for a summer.
Oh no, Zerkers has built a real good swimming pool down there that lasted for years. I think I shudder now when I think of all the insurance cases with anything recreational or all, but that this neighbor should build a swimming pool for all the neighborhood children to swim in, and never thought once about the liability or the insurance that he needed for it.
But he was pretty particular who came there, because we had to come to see you to get to go down there.
Oh. Well, it was probably the nicest pool anywhere, around here anyway.
It had a gravel bottom.
Yeah. So mm-hmm.
It had wood inside.
Yeah, it was pretty shape, really nice. There's Boy Scouts, they built a swimming pool over in Yurkovich's Creek, and they built one over Jackson Creek. There was one more somewhere. Anyway, it filled in after a while. You go swimming there in the mud, it just ooze up to your toes. The water is all down.
How did they build?
You just slip straight, I guess. whole truck or something.
Well, that was a big fun, the Jackson Quarry and the going on hikes and pick and cookouts and things up there was big recreation for us in the summertime. Our mother used to fix a can and give us, oh, like cubes of ham and carrots and potatoes, and we used to build a fire under it and put the can over the fire, and while we went swimming and cook our own stew up there. And one time we went up the top where they had a big flume that went down to wash the gravel in the quarry, and we climbed up on that hill, and the gate was in, so we were just fiddling around. We weren't terribly old either, but old enough to know better. But we lifted up this gate, and all this water come rushing down on the quarry, and the men were still down there working, and they said, "Oh, the dam broke!" And they all come running up the hill, and here they saw us, scared kids, trying to get that gate back in there. Well, we knew the men, or we knew that the men knew our dad, so we made them promise that they would not tell.
I'm sure it got back to dad, though.
What were some of the family rules that your parents had?
Well, they were fairly, not really too strict, but they were pretty strict. They wanted to know where we were going and who we were going with, and I don't think we broke too many rules the day.
How did they discipline you if you did?
We weren't spanked very much. I don't recall ever getting a spanking.
You see that door there and that door there? There's a circle around there. I made a few circles around there. It was hard to catch you when they had two doors like that.
Well, I think Mom was the stronger one with discipline than Dad, kind of. I think he was a little more easygoing.
I think he was too, yes. They didn't rule with an iron hand. They were just pretty firm with what they believed. We always had a calendar, and on Sundays it would take a long time to get through that that devotion that went with that calendar on the weekdays, while we just got by with a little prayer meal time. So they were. I don't believe they ever missed a Sunday at church, and we were expected to go to Sunday school, and they gave us. I think they were just about the right disciplinarians. I think they did a great job.
I think after I got out on my own and used to come back and visit, Mom used to not really appreciate some of the styles I had chosen, especially some of the shoes and things. But I was away in the big city, and I, when I came home to the country, I was should have had sense to tone it down a little, I guess.
Well, let's talk about your social life as young adults. When did you start dating?
I didn't date very early. I went to the Girl Reserve, danced a couple times, and we did a lot of things together. We always went Christmas caroling together. We always went to young people's at church, and we'd go to picnics out at Romer's Rest, and out at a lot of our social life revolved around the church and school. With the community, they always had a Helvetia dance. Not a Helvetia, yeah, a band concert, wasn't it? And then it followed with a dance. This was one of Joe Wenzel's added bits. And so we learned to dance down there, but as far as, you know, dating, I don't think other than a few school dances, I dated very much in high school.
Did your parents have rules about who you were to be with? I mean,
well, I don't think there was that much, because usually if it was the local boys from the church or something that you would go out on a date with, there were a couple of them that I dated, and so I didn't get much flack about them. But then of course, when we went to college, we started dating a lot more.
So tell us about a typical Sunday.
Well, as I recall, we got up early and we put on our Sunday clothes and our Sunday shoes, and I think it was 10 o'clock we went to Sunday school, so we all marched down the road, and if you were a youngster, you sat up on the front steps with a young'un, and if you were a little bit older, you were in Esther Berger's class, and if you were a little bit older, you were in Emma Scheidt's class, and we always went to Sunday school, and then I don't recall whether we always stayed for church until we were a little bit older, and but that was always a must. We always say that people who live closest to church were the last ones there, and sometimes we were the last ones there. And when all the cars were there, then we'd head out the door, and then we would come home and have dinner, and usually it was a Sunday dinner, chicken every Sunday, maybe not chicken, but pork. I remember pork roasts and chicken as being very typical Sunday dinners, and then we often went visiting somewhere, on Emma's or down at Grossen's or somewhere, and Dad would always have to get back and milk the cows, of course, about, what, 5 o'clock, was it? Yeah. Something like that. So we always had to be back in time to milk the cows, and so then we had young people's at 5 or 6 or something like that, and so we would be back and down at the church for an hour and a half, and it was time to come home and get ready for school for the week. So that's the way I recall them. I don't know, maybe Bob has gone to a few ball games and done a few other things.
In the summertime, so on Sundays, there were always lots of picnics to go to. There was always the traditional picnics that went on every summer that were at different weeks, the dairy co-op picnic and the Sunday school picnic and this picnic. I know I came home one summer from the East for 11 weeks or something, and I think 8 out of those 11 weeks we've been on Sunday picnics. So it was real common. Model A with a rumble seat.
Oh, yeah. I tell you.
No, he didn't take everyone.
You would shudder today how he hauled people, kids around.
In the trunk of his car, open, right?
Yeah, he had a stick, and he'd open up the trunk lid, and 3 kids would crawl in the back. And kids would hang on the running board. Both sides, probably a couple kids at least on each side, drive down the road. Can you imagine today doing anything?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Joe was on for the most of the years he's taught up here. He was a single guy. And, I guess a little bit wild.
But
it wasn't on later. He already met Inus, I guess. And his music business.
A little ring.
Okay. I never read.
Oh, that was yours and yours.
Well, Mama's going to drink a little.
There's 2 of them.
Oh, that's fine. Thank you. Oh, I'm sorry.
Which is?
That's pretty good wine.
Well, he used to have award systems or something. Like, I remember going into J.K. Gill's bookstore with him. And
you got a star.
And if you did if you're, maybe he based it on your grades or your attitude.
Well, every day I'm reading. You know, the person that read the best would get a star, and you get 40 pages in your book. And that was really incentive, you know, to try and beat out Dorothy Staley.
But we just loved him and adored him. We just, you know, thought he was the...
He was a classmate of Joe Merchant. Were you, Betty?
I was Annie's classmate. Joe was...
I think... No, Joe was ahead of me a little bit.
Here was a kid that had immigrant parents. I guess they never even talked English at home, particularly. They were very good. I guess he was an outstanding student down here under Joe. And then went on to college and through the engineering school. And then out of the engineering school, he went to work for Westinghouse. And from there, Westinghouse got him into a program, I guess it was three other guys. And they were the guys that worked on the anti-missile.
Oh, is that right? Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I guess it was up there in the first, the Gulf War. You got to see the thing work. I don't know what other part that he worked on. I was always curious, though, that they had one there, a missile that would shoot a missile. So there was some pretty hotshot students came out from under his beginning there.
Would you, go ahead. You were going to say something.
Well, anyway, Joe was saying one time at a picnic, he says he keeps track of most of his students. He said there's only one student that he knows of that ever collected welfare.
Huh?
Yeah, that says quite a bit.
The CEO of Myron Franks, I believe, is one of his students. Didn't Judy go to school with Joe? I'm sure maybe just a little bit. Maybe.
I don't think so. She was about 2 years behind, or three or years behind me, and I had Joe for 2 years.
Oh, so I guess she just missed him. Yep. But Jerry must have, because I think...
Yeah, Jerry was in my year, then she skipped the grade.
Oh, uh-huh.
And went ahead.
Uh-huh. You're talking about Judy Hofer. She's one of the top 10 women executives. She worked for
May Brothers.
And now she's
a... Myron Franks is still part of May Company.
No.
But she is the CEO and the head of the 8 Myron Franks stores.
Yeah, about a 6-digit income.
She grew up out here.
Yeah,
right?
She's our cousin. Her grandmother was our dad's sister.
Well, let's talk about transportation. And I thought, let's compare, like, transportation in your mother and father's period, your childhood, to, like, what you knew of how your grandparents got around.
Well, obviously, the paternal grandparents got around with horse and buggy, if that's the way my dad went to pick them up at the railroad station. I don't know. I doubt if the grandparents ever had a automobile. But I think Dad then, later in his life, I don't know. How were...
Oh, I think Dad was one of the first guys to have an automobile. I think
Dad was
kind of a sporty guy.
Sporty guy when it came to cars. He bought the... And he bought a fine Dodge, and he had, he had some other cars that were pretty nice cars.
That was before he had all of us, though, I think.
Yeah, I think so.
What I remember most of all are those FEM pickups, fix every morning. That's just exactly what we called it. But I used to always love to go to town with him in his pickup.
1918 Dodge, and that was a neat rig. It had a battery and a starter and a gear shift, and most of all the rest of them had Model Ts.
He had one that had a cigarette lighter. It used to be parked in the shed down there. It had a cigarette lighter on a cord, and you pulled it out, and you could, a cigar lighter, and everybody in the back seat could use it, but the people in the front seat better be careful, because if you let it go, it just went like that and flew back into the hole.
Al Piern bought a Model A Ford, 1929 Model A Ford. He told Dad, he says, now that car is the ultimate. There's nothing more they can put on a car. it had electric starter, and it had windows, enclosed car, and it had locks, and it had, there was nothing else they could put on a car. Watch our car today.
Well, I remember Bob when you went to when you were old. Well, Bob drove when he was about 8 years old, I think. We had this Model A Ford, and he used to drive us around sometime. Mom used to drive too, but when I was a small child or a baby, I rolled off the seat, and she kind of went in the side of the road, and I think she stopped driving after that. But I remember Bob and his cars. He had Model A's, I think, and he had a winter one and a summer one. And I asked you what the difference was, and you said, well, the winter one had holes in the floorboards in the bottom, so you couldn't use it. The summer one, you couldn't use it in the winter, or the water would splash out. You remember when you used to have two cars?
Well, I had one that didn't have fenders. It was kind of wet and cold. And
we used to make a big trip every, maybe once a summer, maybe twice a year, I don't know, to my Uncle Alfred and Aunt Emma's up in Independence, Oregon. And this was always a big, big day. A dad would hire somebody to do the chores for him. We got up very early. And I think they were Dodges, and they had these flaps on them that you kind of snapped onto the side of the car. And it took us maybe 3-4 hours to get up the Independence, which now you can do in an hour and a half. So we'd spent the day up there and come back, and it was just quite an affair to get family up there. But I remember that being very special. I don't know if you kids remember that or not.
I just remember the pickups. I still remember when I went to college down at Corvallis at Oregon State, they would drive me over to Hillsboro to the Oregon Motor Stages in the pickup, and then I would ride the bus to college. And a lot of kids used to get a ride all the way to college, and I felt a little deprived that I had to go in that bus all the time, but I shouldn't feel that. I don't feel that way now. Lucky that I got to go.
I never did see a real wagon around here. I mean a
carriage wagon.
Carriage. Did you ever see one around here? They must have had one. You remember seeing one around your place, Glenn?
Yeah, used to have
a wagon that they rode in.
Yeah, they had hacks, and they had Dad's old buggy that he courted him up till not too long ago. After somebody came in and stole the thing, and then I got it back, and he decided to sell it and get rid of it. But the hack was kind of like the station wagon. You could put seats on it, about three different ones, and you could haul a whole big family in it. And sometimes they did have a top on them, and it had springs. And the old farm wagon didn't have any springs, but it had big wheels that pulled easy over a rough barrel and rough terrain. And then the buggy, that was the sports car. That you put one horse on there, probably a trotter. And it spiffied up the harness, and everything was spit and shined, and a little board in front, and a little whip on the side, and well, it was just the cool cats out there.
The most I remember of riding in any of those is once in a while, in the winter when we had enough snow, Dad had a sleigh or a sled or something, and we took the horses and rode down to the store on with that horse and sled. But I don't ever remember seeing or riding a buggy, but I'm sure they must have had them.
A sled on the snow or on the mud?
On the snow.
Well, it never very snowed very much around here.
Well, it did when we were kids, it seemed like it.
Yeah, one of the prettiest levels I remember was when we was in grade school. It kind of started out maybe like today, but it was kind of cool. We thought it was going to rain. And I went down there to school, and pretty soon the sky opened up, well, a few trickles, and then pretty soon it really opened up. And the time school was up, it must have been about 8 inches of snow, and the high school was wet out. And the next morning, I guess we had about 18 inches of snow.
Mm-hmm.
And it all laid down pretty. It just didn't come blowing in on a big wind. It just cleaned it all off of everything.
Let's talk about communication.
Two longs and a short, wasn't it? No, three one. Ours was right over there in the corner, and our ring was 3-1. 3-1. Three longs and a short. And
it was a party line. If that phone rang, then everybody else would know that phone was ringing and could pick it up.
And we could always tell who Mom was talking to when she was talking on the phone, because Mrs. Bishop was German and had a German dialect. Aunt Emma had a little different dialect. Other people talked a little differently, and she would change the way she spoke to kind of accommodate. And there was an operator there, so if you had a call long distance, you talked to the operator, and
during the Depression, when your dad put his car up on blocks, did the farmers still maintain communications during that time?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure they did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure they did.
So they considered that more important than the automobile?
Well, I don't think it cost very much.
I don't think the telephone bill was very much, no.
It's probably $1 a month. What's good long distance? $1.25.
Well, when did they first put phones in?
Probably the turn of the century, or before the turn of the century, I guess. Right? I don't know, when was it, Glenn, do you know?
Oh, I don't know.
I think it was
earlier.
Right at the turn of the century.
Some of the people used to have, speaking of communication, used to have those crystal radios.
Crystal sets.
We used to go over to Aunt Emma's house, and there was this John Linder or something, wasn't it, that lived over there that used to have a crystal set, and we used to always say that man's crazy. He talks to himself.
Well, I don't know. Frank had made one, too. Frank was kind of into that, and Roy kind of tinkered with that stuff, too. And they always had kind of headphones things that we... That was one of the fun things we did when we'd go over to Aunt Emma's, just get to listen to those things.
Out of the Poplar Mechanics, you know, you buy a little crystal there, and then you had the coils, and you could adjust that.
Yeah.
I think that's where I first heard old Lawrence Welk from, where is on ballroom.
Is that right? Yeah.
They could relay broadcast then already. Come out, KOA, I guess.
And then remember our first
radio?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, and the first program we heard, I think, was Amos and Andy.
Right, and we listened to Jack Armstrong, the All-American Boy, and
we had one of those that kind
Fibber
of mounted
McGee and
up,
Molly, you know. And I don't remember what year that was that we got that.
Right, as soon as we got electricity, and that was in
36,
yeah. Huh? Mm-hmm. That's about 7 years.
Had an old wind-up phonograph. Well, that wasn't communications, really. That was more entertainment.
and a player accordion, an accordion that had rolls in it that you would play it.
There were two newspapers, the Oregon Journal and the Oregonian. We usually got the Oregonian.
We got the Journal.
Oh, did we?
Yeah, the Oregonian came in the morning, and the Journal came in the afternoon.
There was a news telegram, too.
Oh, that's right, there was a news telegram. Mm-hmm. And the Hillsborough Argus. The Hillsborough Argus was always an important, that came out weekly, and it was always done in a little different print than the other newspaper, so that usually got saved a few days.
And the mail came once a day, and it was put in the mailbox, and this Milty used to be the mail carrier, and he would get in trouble for harassment these days, I think, because when we'd reach in for the mail, he'd grab your arm and kiss it. And we and we didn't like being kissed by the mailman. So we used to hide behind the cheese house when we saw him coming up the hill, and we would look and we'd hide behind the cheese house, and as soon as we heard him go down over the hill, we'd run to the mailbox, and then he'd be looking in his rearview mirror and seeing us go out there, and he'd say, well, how come you hide from me? How come you run? But we didn't want to tell him, well, it's because he'd just slobber all over our arm. And then he used to want to give us a ride home from school all the time when we came home for lunch. Do you remember that, Bob?
Mm-hmm.
And then we had his crowd.
Hang on his fender.
Yeah, or squeeze in beside him there, beside the mail. I didn't like that either.
Didn't he come in the schoolhouse and give you a spiel once in a while?
Oh, yeah. One time he came in the school. He had a package for the school. And Joel Wenzel was walking around, and he just walked right around behind him. You remember that, Vernon? Just following him around. All the kids were laughing, you know, and Joe, he couldn't figure out what they were laughing about, you know. He was one step right behind Joe. But he was a real clown. He could really entertain. He was a mail carrier for many years.
One time, I guess he was drinking a little too much by the time he got to Gibble Snyder's. And he dumped his car over the bank and it tipped over on the side. And then he had to get pulled out. I mean, he did all these things and he never got fired. And then I remember walking home from school, he'd always, well, he had time to stop and look where he tipped his car over, because he could find pennies, you know. People would leave money in a box for a postage, you know, and collect pennies and nickels and all that. And it's not stuck in the mud out there, we were careful.
He'd also write articles in the Argus every week.
Yeah, he did, dude, when he got retired, didn't he?
Well, even before.
Should have saved some.
But he always kind of mentioned Helvetia in these articles, you know. He kind of had a heart for Helvetia.
I always thought all postmen were Milties. It's the only fun we had.
Well, there was only two routes in the county. Yeah, they had him out in North County, and there was another one out in Francis Beach out on South End.
That's unbelievable.
He had a one big route.
Yes, yeah. He did.
And he started carrying it by horse.
Did he really?
Uh-huh. I just couldn't believe tonight as I drove into the driveway here. I guess I haven't been here, or I haven't arrived here at night for years and years. All the lights down there. Yeah. My goodness, it just reminded me when we would come out and stay in Manzanita, and then we would have to fly back to New Jersey, and I hated to come in at nighttime, because if you flew into New York, New Jersey area in the nighttime, you saw so many lights all over, and I'd say, why am I coming back to such a metropolis, you know? But when I stood out here and saw all those lights over tonight, I was just shocked.
Well, when we were kids, I mean, it was still pretty pioneer. I mean, I don't think the population in the whole Washington County was over 20 or 30,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
Hillsborough had about 3,000.
one of the most devastating things I think that happened in our childhood, as far as the community was concerned. If there were a fire, this was really, really bad. And our neighbors up here, and I'm not sure what year it was, a home burned.
Yeah, 32. That's when I was.
When you were born?
Uh-huh. Wanger's
house. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. In fact, that chair over there was one of the chairs that came out of Wanger's house. They saved some of their furniture, but you know, people just lost almost everything in a fire. And there was a fire. Wasn't Dave Hershey's house burnt down near you?
Yes.
Uh-huh. That was in. I mean, here we can remember these fires as being a real.
I can remember when I was a kid. I mean, we didn't have the rural fire department out here yet. Although they did call Hillsborough, but they wouldn't come out with paid. But Dave had started out in his woodshed, I guess, from him smoking his pipe and being shaky. And then it first burned up the side of the house, and Elmer and I saw the thing. And we made a run for it, and we got out the water hose, and then his water system was just hardly trickle out the end of the hose. So that wasn't much. And then I thought, well, I'd run the creek with a bucket of water, get a bucket of water down there, and I ran down there. And I don't know whether I went into shock or what, but ooh, that seemed like a long trip back, and my shoes were lead. And finally, more neighbors gathered now around, and then the decision was made that it was going to be a loss, and so they start emptying the house out. And so they took out a lot of the furnishings. And then they were without their house, and they were pretty old people then. Then over at Helvetia, they had a fundraising dance or two. Got some money together, enough to buy a truckload or two of lumber. And then there were volunteers came in there, and some of them were carpenters volunteers, and they hammered up the little house that's down there right now.
Hmm.
Which we own now. But,
I remember it was quite common too for barns to catch on fire, because they would put hay in there that was not fully cured, and then the combustion, they would start off. I remember going to more barn fires than house fires.
Oh, and then talking about barn fires, that one of the Hershey house was burning. Vernon's dad, he was over there, and I don't know, he was looking around, I guess, just looking to see whether there was anything else starting around. It was a hot, dry day. And sure enough, the little barn that I got down there had a fire burning on the roof. And the only thing it had was one of them backpack sprays, held about 5 gallons of water and a trombone pump. And I ran up there and I just barely squirted up on the roof. But every time I put a squirt up there, the fire kept coming. And I thought, oh my gosh, I better go inside and look. So I went inside, and then I could see, and stood in a pile of hay about that high, and squirted that water up there, and I got it out with that 5 gallons of water.
Oh, and there's a fire in the community too. He'd go out and ring the church bell years ago. You know,
yeah.
That was a signal there was a fire. And then when Chris Christensen's house burned down, Mrs. Christensen's her wedding ring was in the, her engagement and wedding ring was in the house. She was quite concerned about that. It was all in flames, you know. And then Glenn's dad, Fred, he reached in the window and got that ring, and he was a hero of the hero of the day.
Oh, that was weird. I can remember. Yeah, you got a big kiss for that.
Yeah, he was anyway, a real hero.
When the word came out on the old telephone, I guess, that there was a house fire there, it was milking time in the evening. And, gee, they live way up here on the Amalogi Trail, or, yeah. And the others, well, it was worth going up there to that fire because it could be burnt down before it got there, it seemed like. But anyway, Dad finished milking the cow and then decided, well, they better go. So everybody took off. I got left at home to finish up the church. I guess the east wind was blowing something ferocious that night. And I guess it kept blowing the fire kind of away, come through the roof, and then it kept blowing it away, and that house burned down real slow like a candle, I guess. And so they could go in and around through that house and save, I guess, quite a few things before it burned out.
Can you remember any other kind of natural disaster? Yes.
Oh, the Tillamook burn. Oh, my. 1933 was the first big burn. And you couldn't see the church. It was just, smoke was just so heavy that it was just terrible. I remember a few years later as a child being so frightened because the sky was really red from an, you know how it gets sometime in the summertime. And I thought it was another fire because that burned, it burned many thousands and thousands of acres in 1933. And then it burned again in 1939 and again in 1945. But that was terrifying then.
Did that give you a fear of fire too?
Oh, yeah.
I had that too.
Did you really?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I was wondering. I finally kind of related it back, you know, uh-huh. To that poem with. Well, it was the east wind was blowing most of the time, and then blowing the smoke out over the ocean. And I remember we'd sleep out on the porch in the summer nights, and you'd just see that sky just all aglow out there, and the fire just a raging, you know. And it was, yeah, spooky. It was scary.
Oh, it was.
And then it was later when the winds changed in the fall, it was still burning out there, and then it blew all that smoke in. I remember, yeah, it was just like a thicker than a fog.
Oh, it was something.
Yeah. Then ashes would drop in around the whole over the place.
Mm-hmm.
But didn't Joe Winslow take us out there to replant trees?
Yeah, after the fire, they reforested it, and we went out on a trip with Joe Winslow and planted trees.
I think there was a program in the Portland schools too, but I'm not sure it was as early as Joe Winslow because he always seemed to be a few years ahead of everybody else. But all sixth graders in the western part of the state pretty much spent a day planting trees out in the Tillamook Burn. And so I've seen films on the Tillamook Burn since then.
And then everybody thought the earth was scorched and would never grow another tree and this and that and the other. I guess that's the beginning of it. Now they're starting to re-harvest that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
They're harvesting smaller trees, but they say they're getting more board feet than they did off the big trees.
Mm-hmm.
So on smaller logs.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ran a whole cycle there.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the Indian experience that you had with the local Indians?
I remember Dad finding lots of arrowheads, indicating that there were lots of Indians in the area. As he was farming, he would find them in the ground. But I don't remember too much about Indians around here.
Hey, Missy, don't record over that movie.
Do you remember anything about the Indians?
No, I just remember a few stories that apparently there was an Indian family that lived down about where Abe Youngin's house was. And, but I don't think they had any confrontations with the Indians or anything like that. I think they were pretty peaceful dealings that they had. But there were arrowheads and a few other stones and bowls and that sort of thing indicating that Indians did lived out through this area.
Yeah, Kanai was an Indian. Kanai lived on Jackson Quarry Road. And his daughter married Keffer. I believe that's the way it was. Mrs. Keffer was an Indian. And they had a daughter, Mabel. And she married Frank Williams, which owned Williams Potato Chip Company in Portland. But I knew her quite well. She used to give me a ride home from school when I was, I'd stay for after school, high school for sports, and I'd have to hitchhike home. And she somehow would be driving, she'd be driving home, and she'd pick me up. And so I got to know her quite well. Anyway, it came out, there was a story went around that they were Hawaiian. But she didn't know anything about that. She didn't like that story. But anyway, they were really fine people, these Williams. But let's see, who else were Indians around here?
Do you remember stories? Were you told stories about the Indians as you were children?
Well, I was told about Kanai, that he was hew out bolts, which are ribs and ships, and he'd hew these out of a crooked log, and then Dad hauled them down to the river for him, and anyway, there was good money in these hewing out these bolts, and Dad used to haul them down there for him.
Dad really had a lot of Indian arrowheads set, but someone came by, didn't they, and bought a lot of his things?
Well, there was a museum out of Roy that the gentleman said, well, we put them on display so people could see them forever. And he died, and then they auctioned them all off, which was kind of dispersed the whole museum all over. But there was one field up there in our place that Dad used to find quite a few arrowheads. And there was one, I think it was Thanksgiving or Christmas.
You were
here?
Yeah.
The whole family was here, and we went up for a walk up in the woods. And I was mentioning that Dad used to find a lot of arrowheads in this field.
It was kind of a clear day after a rainy day, wasn't it?
I said, maybe we just plow too deep now, and they're plowed under or something. And just as I said that, Betty looked down, and here was this little arrowhead laying right there.
Actually, it was Karen.
Was it Karen? Yeah. I mean, it was just...
Bob said, I never found one. Our daughter looked down and picked one up.
Well, tell us about the sporting events that happened in the community, like Swiss wrestling.
Oh, too bad Bert isn't here. He was a big man, has long arms.
Now, Bert is your brother.
Youngest brother.
He's in California for a vacation. But he's got long arms and big man. And he was very good at that. And after he had finished school and gone to work, he worked out of Sacramento, wasn't it? And there was a Swiss community down there, and he came home with this crown of laurel things that was up in his room for a long time. They gave them a crown of laurel.
A cross.
Oh, uh-huh, yeah. Uh-huh. And he was a Swiss wrestler in the family. I remember going to the Swiss picnics in Oaks Park, wasn't it Oaks Park where they have them?
Cedarville.
Well, Cedarville,
too.
Yeah.
Oaks, too.
Yeah, and watching them do this, and didn't they did some around here too, didn't they?
Down in our backyard.
Oh, uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Well, describe it. Describe.
Well, they seem like they take a hold of their pants, don't they, right here? And where do they take the other? Vernon probably knows. Vernon's probably a good one. Huh?
Yeah, he's got to win a couple of crowns.
Yeah. 70 of them. Uh-huh. But they had a pair of pants, cut off pants, canvas pants with a leather belt. And you took a grip. They actually come from the mountains of Switzerland. And you took this the grip, and you always had a, when you were throwing, you always had to have a grip on the pants. The rounds went for 5 minutes out in the sawdust, and once the round started, why, anything almost went, as long as you kept a grip in the hand, or one grip on the pants.
One hand,
yep.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
I remembered one hole that was called a schlunk, and I thought that was the neatest word. Schlunk.
Well, didn't you do some Swiss wrestling down at Tillamook?
I never did.
No. Oh, arm wrestling. What did you do down in Tillamook when you got hurt?
No, not me.
Not you.
Just for
the dog down Minnesota boys, though, they was always inviting me down there to go Swiss wrestling, you know, and they just used me for bait and chew up. Practice.
Did you ever wrestle with Bert?
Did I? Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Up and down the coast.
Oh, did you really?
20 years I used to wrestle about.
Uh-huh.
Well, go ahead. I was going to say describe.
Oh.
You know, describe when you're doing it. What are the things that you hear? Like, if you're the person that's wrestling, what are you hearing and feeling?
Just how strong you are. You can beat that guy. You can beat him no matter. But they have these wrestling matches up and down the coast.
But how do you pin him? He has to put him
touch
on his shoulders
fall.
Down.
Yeah. Touch fall. And just, and it's fast sometimes. There's no 1 second or nothing. It's real fast, and it's, and they still do it. We still got the contest. There's, in Portland, there's one in August, first weekend of August. Then Tacoma, there'll be one the second weekend in August. Then they go to California. And a lot of guys, they travel up and down, younger guys, they travel up and down the coast, following these shrimp fish. There's probably about 12 of them a year.
So to pin someone, you have one hand on their pants. You have to throw them down on the ground, and then their shoulders have to touch?
Both shoulders touch at the same time.
On their back?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you get them down one way, and then any way you can, roll them over onto his back, get both shoulders down, and he's just bridging or any way to get out, too.
And does it have to be for a certain time with those two shoulders? 1 second?
One
and
second.
That's
no, touch. Just at the same time.
Okay.
But then when they have a swing fest, that's the day they have it. It starts out, is their picnic goes along with it, I guess. Mm-hmm.
You're matched up with somebody compared to you, and then if you win, you go against somebody else that won compared to you. And gradually, at the end of the day, there's a first, second, third, fourth place. You wrestle for points too, and then they have a big party at night. And
get to kiss the girl.
Yeah, get the crowns. You get this laurel wreath, and sometimes, and then it used to be once in a while we get medals or trophies too, and then they have other prizes too.
Is it by age and weight?
No,
weight?
It's all open, any weight and any age. From now it's from 18 on up.
So how do they match you up?
Against somebody else with the same kind of experience, number of crowns. Hmm. And then you go from there and they just keep.
So this is a tradition that's been handed down and brought actually from Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
But anybody can participate in it?
Yeah, mostly, hardly anybody except Swiss descendants participate in it, though. And we practice, start practicing in March sometimes. We put sawdust shavings pit in the barn, practice wrestling. Then we go down to Imperial Valley for the first one in March, and then in May and June, they're up and down the coast.
Do you wear special pants?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Leather or
they're
soft?
They're a canvas, kind of, with a And they're real strong. Kind of canvas burlap. Real heavy. And they're come down to about here, then you roll them up and you get your grips and start.
So they're shorts.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. These cups or rolls.
One, if your hand goes around the back of him and one hand down in front, the hand in the back got his belt in front, and he's got the same position, and then he goes.
And you each have to have one hand on each other at all times?
No, just the guy, if you're throwing the guy, you got to have a hand on him. Okay. The one guy he's trying to get away, he can get away any way he can, crawling out of the ring or anything. At this same contest, though, then later in the day after the wrestling's over, they got a rock throwing contest. These rocks weigh anywhere from 40 to 165 pounds. Some of them you can barely pick up and maybe get them 8 feet. And then after that, they got the party and they dance all night.
And you call them Schwing?
Schwingfests.
Schwing?
Yep.
Can you spell that?
S-C-H-W-I-N-G.
Okay. What other sporting events did you have as children, do you remember?
Well, didn't you play tennis?
We tried.
No, we tried, yeah. We tried.
Ping pong, the dining room table here. Well, the dining room table was square then. And,
but I don't know, didn't you and Lou build a tennis court out here in the table?
We used to be able to clip the net across on the table. And we played a lot of ping pong. We played quite a few board games, checkers and Chinese checkers. And
did all that, you know, when we had the kerosene lamp, was about all you could see was on mm-hmm. the table, playing mm-hmm. a lot of checkers.
Yeah. Checkers and well, those dominoes.
Those softball games that we played, did you guys ever come up for those that we used to play down here in Helvetia? Jeff Daff's place?
There yeah, he, I played up there.
Yeah, we used to play every Sunday in the summertime. We'd have this ball game going, so I think we played a lot of softball. And
I used to ride my bicycle around, all around the loop, down past.
Yeah, well, I was trying to was in the house in school there. The softball team was likely to have about as many girls as boys. We never had enough otherwise to mm-hmm. the team. So, I mean, mm-hmm. it was integrated. And mm-hmm. So, it had to be nice for girls so they'd come play ball.
We used to ride our bicycles around the school recess, you know. And just, you know, he'd go as fast as he could. But during the Depression, WPA put a basement in the school. And they dumped the dirt out in front of the school. And then there it was built up pretty good, and there was a drop-off that went down towards the road. We call that the Tickle Hill.
Oh, yeah.
And he'd go down that to that corner of that hill and as fast as he could go, and then he'd drop off there.
Then down at that school too, there used to be a well down across the road, and for a long time they carried water up to the school from the well, and then it got where they put a pump down there, and the pump would quit once in a while, and this then we could always find an excuse to spend half a day working that pump trying to get it going so they don't have water at school, but we never did turn out very good. Excuse to get away from school, though.
The school, they had, Joe Wenzel started this too. This fill that was WPA put all this dirt, you know, he planted in the garden, flower garden. You know, every graduating class would plant a plant there, and there was a lot of other flowers. But for punishment, if you done something wrong, you'd have to go out there and spade in the garden. So one day, one of the kids was out there spading, and a car came along, threw a clod over the bank, hit Elmer Gerber's hood.
Andy over.
And then he'd throw the ball.
Here come the ball over the hill, or over to school. The kid would catch it on the other side, then he'd run around the school and how many kids you could touch or hit with that ball. And then they were in your side. Eventually, there'd be maybe one or two kids.
But you had to catch the ball first.
Yeah.
Before you had it was.
Could it bounce before you caught it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they catch
it. Over the school, and you had to catch it before it bounced. Mm-hmm. If you didn't, then what happened?
Well, then you had to throw it back.
You divide up the sides evenly to begin with. Yeah. Half the kids on one side of the school, half on the other.
Eventually you'd get down to where there was maybe one or two kids on the other team and all the other kids were on the winning team then.
I'm sorry, did I interrupt you? You were talking about hoops.
Well, you had a stick and you'd nail a little strip of wood on there, probably 6 inches long. And then, I don't know, I guess some old blacksmith, her dad used to make these hoops, you know, they're probably about 8-10 inches in diameter. About an inch wide, you know.
Some of them came off the whole hub off a wagon.
And then you'd stick that stick inside that hub, you know, or that little hoop, you know, and it'd start rolling, then you'd push it. You could just push that all over, you know. You kind of steer it around.
Well, was there any competition with it? Or
well, it was competition, but it was a pretty good trick to keep it rolling. You know? keep that.
They used to have the highest swing set I've ever seen down at school, too. It was pretty swinging. They had about three kids where you could swing. Yeah. And posts were up there.
Oh, man, yeah. They used to have one of the best swings in the whole country. Yeah. Ooh, that was a high one.
Yeah. You used to jump off into the air.
Oh, yeah.
And you can catch that kid and get a ride up there 10 feet and then come back down again, too.
Oh, you get on there and you pump, you know. Mm-hmm. And you get that thing going really up there, man, you know, it's a wonder nobody got killed.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's why I asked about broken bones.
Yeah. But I mean, that was, some of those guys would pump up there, you know, way up, clear up to the top, you know.
And you'd come almost straight down once in a while, and then, yeah.
I think Joe Wenzel was the only one that got the broken bone. Didn't he pole vaulting or cross or something in his book he was telling about it? Yeah.
Pole vaulting was a big deal in Helvetia School.
And
Joe Wenzel started that too, but even Irene Ritter was pole vaulting. She was a good one.
Helvetia was the only school with the indoor play shed too. It had a good sized roof, and it was really neat. We were dirt floor, but it was really a good play shed.
Yeah, it was.
It was always kind of
need one in this rainy weather.
The floor was always kind of wet in here.
Yeah, we were
Talk about broken bones, though, Bob. You were the big toe roller here, and that was his sport in track in high school, and he broke his ankle twice. And Two years in a row.
I sprained it in one track meet, and then I, about 3 weeks later, I sprained the other one. I was back in crutches again.
Is there a subject that any of you would like to add that we haven't talked about tonight?
I think we've covered kind of the waterfront.
I have one last question that I'd like to ask then to kind of wrap it up. And that is, you've seen a lot of changes because the time that you've been here. And I'd like to know, what do you think about all of the changes that have happened?
Well, I think we've lived in a very, very exciting time in history where we have seen so many changes, and although we hate to see what's going on between here and Portland, all the development that's going on, it's bound to happen, and Oregonians will meet the challenge.
I'm just delighted every time I come back from New Jersey and come to Helvetia to see a community that has developed and has grown so nicely, and the old homes that I remember are restored, and the new homes that are put up are so nice. It's so much in contrast to where my husband grew up in Paterson, New Jersey. He lived on the street where one of the vice presidents of the nation lived, and which was very nice residential section. And it is just completely, you know, gone down completely. It's just a shame what happened there. And it's such a contrast. And then when I come out here and see that where I was born and where I grew up, it's just exactly the opposite. It's a beautiful, beautiful area. And I'm just real thrilled that it's that way.
Well, I look at the old days were good days, but they were hard days. You know, we have it so much easier now. Life is a lot more, I don't know if it's more pleasant or not, but you're more social back in those days, but life was really pretty tough. You know, you have to go out and go to the old outhouse. That wasn't a very pleasant thing, you know. And you had to work hard, you know, and things weren't, you didn't have tools to help you. And have riding lawnmowers. Well, we didn't have a lawn.
Stick the bull out.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, I think we developed, you know, pretty good worth ethics that we passed on down to our children. I think Grandma and Grandpa would be real proud to know that there's, what, three or four of the great-grandchildren who have their PhDs and all. It's a lot easier for them. And I don't know if they quite appreciate things as much as we do, having it easier all the time. But still, I think they've continued the worth ethic that we developed.
That's another question to ask you girls, so you know both sides of the coin. But it used to be the woman, she stayed home, kept the house, did the cooking, and did all those things and looked after the kids. Then we got electricity to fix the chores out of a lot of jobs. Everything's almost automated. So she thinks she's got time, she runs off to town, and there's two of them, they gotta work. Is it easier to have that job in town, or would it be easier to stay in the house?
Well, I was a working mother after our children were all in school, and I asked them, do you feel deprived that I went back to work? And they said, no, not at all. And of course I had summers off when they were home, but I think they developed a lot more responsibility than they probably would have had I been home all the time.
How do you feel? That? I mean, that you either kept the house, that would have been easier, or just...
Well, it wouldn't have been as much fun, I don't think. It wouldn't have been as challenging.
You have more fun at the job.
Right, yeah.
Okay.
You're sure more comfortable now. You get up in the morning, the house is warm. No. You don't have to climb out of that cold bed, run down and start the fire. First thing in the morning, you get it warmed up.
Uh-huh.
And you got a shower every day instead of once a week.
Right.
Yeah, Betty talks about heat and water in the kitchen stove, I can remember. See, you can fire that stove all day long, but I don't think it's got about a half full of hot water. Uh-huh. I don't know. That seemed to be max out right there, half and half. But growing up with a family of six kids, the first guy there, or first two or three, got a warm bath and the rest of the So it was kind of had a discussion there or something. Who was going first? Don't take all the hot water.
Thank you very much.